This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and make a wish.
I don't know other animals that gaze upwards. There's a deep sense that what's above us is greater than us, bigger than us, more powerful than us.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are.
Whether it's Disney, deGrasse Tyson of the Church of Physics, or some other spirit guide, they all invite us to look up into the night sky to escape our earthly prisons of troubling events and unpredictable trends. We need that escape, especially now. But just try and find our galaxy these days, or even the planets.
This is Laura from Portland. Starlight, star bright, the only star I see tonight. Oh, how I struggle and oh, how I fight, just for a glimpse of your dimming light.
Later this hour, we'll have a conversation about how we've soiled our earthly sandbox with light and increasingly cannot behold the heavens above. Like Laura, tell us your impressions of what we are losing in our light-polluted world and your strategy for finding the clear, dark night to wave to our Milky Way neighbors. Phone home, y'all. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number, but we begin with an earthly discussion of unpredictability here on Earth. Richard Thaler has been called the father of behavioral economics. He advises us to pay attention to the turbulence around us, not the calm waters, if we want to know where the river is headed.
I guess I enjoy the role of the troublemaker, the kid that's noticing that the emperor is naked. Starting back in graduate school, I would hear the description of the people we were supposedly studying, and I would say, really? That's what we're those are the people we're trying to study? It's better to get people mad than to have them ignore you.
Richard Thaler is professor of behavioral science and economics at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He's author of Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioral Economics. It's the story of why he's definitely not ignored anymore and why his insights into unpredictability should make us all more confident about deciphering the trends we see around us.
I'm interested in learning about the world, understanding the world better. Think of the analogy between physics and engineering. The physics we learn in high school of objects moving around in a vacuum in a frictionless surface, you know, that's a great way of learning the basics. But if you wanted to shoot a rocket to the moon or build a bridge that won't fall down, you're going to have to take into account lots of other factors. And that's the same with economics. It's very simple to write down a model in which everybody is really smart and unemotional. It's harder to write down a model where people are walking through the grocery store and the path they take through the store influences the things that they buy because their attention is grabbed by something. But of course, that is truth. And as a result, stores spend millions of dollars learning the best way of designing. The milk's always in the back. That's the thing you buy most often. So they want to make you walk as far as possible to pass as many temptations as possible. The high markup items will be on your way. You know, but that world is a lot more interesting and a lot more fun because people are interesting and fun.
People got very interesting and maybe not so much fun in the financial crisis of 2008, 2007, when you had the entire market poised on a kind of crisis point mathematically and very few people able to pull the levers. You're dealing with the behaviors and psychologies of the Ben Bernankes and the Timothy Geithners of the world, and in the middle of a presidential campaign, there's high emotion. I remember talking to a finance fellow who looked at something called an index of shipping, which basically told you how much it cost to buy space on a container ship, and the entire index had frozen, which was equivalent to him of the lights going out all over the earth. That level of emotion was just really off the scale. Is this a time that you are really reveling in, or is this a time when really economists need to go away and doctors need to come in and fix things?
Well, I'm not going to say that the financial crisis, I was leaping for joy. It was a catastrophe, The aftermath of the crisis, once we got through, let's say, after the President Obama got elected, I think at that point there's more fault to be blamed, and but I would say particularly with Congress, because that was an opportunity. We had enormous unemployment and very low interest rates, and any rational economy will take that opportunity to start building stuff. You know, we have horrible infrastructure in this country. You know, we have bridges all around the country that are ready to fall into rivers. We could have spent the last 10 years fixing those, using unemployed workers, cheap resources, and borrowing at negative interest rates. It's just crazy not to do that.
Retirement savings, if we were to contrast the ways in which people thought about retirement and about acquiring assets for a rainy day when they're older, in the period of the 1940s when Social Security came into being, and now where Social Security exists, but there's also a huge number of other sort of financial tools to allow you to have a retirement. Would you say that behavioral economics has helped people to change the way they view retirement?
Yeah, I think it's probably the place where we've had the biggest impact. And the real change, the sea change, was the transformation from the old-fashioned defined benefit pension plans that my father's generation had. And employees had nothing to do. You just work there, and then you're going to get a check for the rest of your life. When we started to switch to defined contribution plans, 401ks and the like, we just all of a sudden told employees, you have to become your own financial planner, broker. This is really hard, figuring out how much to save and how to invest it. So three ideas from behavioral economics have kind of transformed that industry. The first is called automatic enrollment. It used to be in order to join the plan, you had to fill out a bunch of forms. Then we suggested maybe it would be better to say, unless you fill out these forms, you're in. Well, that makes a huge difference, it turns out. The second is we suggested something I call Save More Tomorrow, where you invite people to increase their saving rate gradually over time, because we all have more self-control in the future. Like, we're planning diets next month, not tonight. Certainly not today at lunch. And the third innovation was creating default investment vehicles, meaning if you don't want to do this, just put it in this fund and people can just go on automatic pilot. And that's what people want because, you know, we don't fix our own cars
anymore.
No. And the stakes here are even bigger.
Can you win a Nobel Prize for misbehaving?
Well, that depends on my Swedish friends. not for this book, because Nobel Prizes are awarded with about a 30-year lag. So they're now dipping into the 1980s. The good news about that is no matter how obnoxious I am on this show, it won't affect them because they're only paying attention to what happened 30 years ago.
And if they did, they'd begin to see the impact of behavioral economics.
Well, of course, they've already given my friend Danny Kahneman a Nobel Prize. So they know we're around.
Richard Thaler, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Richard Thaler is professor of behavioral science and economics at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business and author of Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioral Economics. For the people of the UK, there is very much a sense of a morning of hope in the aftermath of the murder of Labour Member of Parliament Jo Cox, gunned down and stabbed in her Northern England constituency by a suspect who may represent a latent violent impulse in British society. Killed 1 week shy of the referendum over continued British membership in the European Union, Cox represented something in British politics as rare as this horrible crime. Here is a bit of her speech in the House of Commons in January, where she celebrated her multi-ethnic community and introduced herself to the nation.
Batley and Spurn is a gathering of typically independent, no-nonsense, proud Yorkshire towns and villages. Our communities have been deeply enhanced by immigration, be it Irish Catholics across the constituency or Muslims from Indian Gujarat or Pakistan, principally from Kashmir. And whilst we celebrate our diversity, the thing that surprises me time and time again as I travel around the constituency is that we are far more united and have far more in common than that which divides us.
Joe Cox's killer allegedly yelled Britain First, the name of a far-right group, before the attack, and questions about motive here have caused both pro- and anti-Brexit camps to suspend their campaigns, a move that could have global implications, according to Simon Hicks, professor of political science at the London School of Economics.
I mean, it's a little early to tell and to understand what the impact of this will be on the debate. I mean, I think a lot of it depends on how they identify the motive of the killer. We already know that he had some connections to some extreme right groups. We have not had exactly his motive for murdering her confirmed. Was it because he was opposed to the fact that she was a very prominent advocate of refugee and migrant interests in the UK? Or was it because she was a very prominent local politician campaigning to remain in the EU? If it's the latter of those two things, I think that could have quite a profound impact on the campaign. If it's the former, then I think we will just have a period of mourning and early next week they'll just return to normal, but perhaps with the rhetoric toned down for the last few days of the campaign.
And the rhetoric has been very, very high. There's been, you know, charges of fear-mongering and excessive sort of charges and countercharges in the debate. Explain why the reason perhaps that virtually all of the UK is on pins and needles over the developments in this case is just because of how rare a crime like this is in the UK as compared with, say, the United States, where this happens, you know, every other day.
Yeah. Gun crime in general is very, very low in the UK compared to not just the United States, but most other developed countries in the world. And so one of the big questions is, how did the guy get a gun? Nobody has a gun. Where did it come from? And the second thing is, it's just extremely rare that there is an attack on a politician. We had an attack on the last time a politician was murdered was by the IRA in the 1980s. We've only had an attempted stabbing on a politician about 10 years ago. So it's extremely rare. The other thing, of course, that really is tragic for people is this was a young, very dynamic woman with very small, very young children, aged 3 and 5, a very committed local politician. And she sort of epitomized all that was good about politics and somebody committed to public service and wanting to go into politics because she really wanted to help people.
And indeed, extending upon the sentiments of Joe Cox's original speech in the House of Commons earlier this year, a new person to politics, but someone who celebrates the new diversity in the UK, who is not at all ambivalent about the ways in which the UK has changed and seemed almost to be excited about the future ahead.
Yeah, I mean, she represented a lot of what young British people feel. What we know is that Britain has become a very open, very liberal, very multi-religious, multi-ethnic place. And younger people in this country, we know from survey data, seem to be far more happier with that and have a far more positive opinion of that than older generations do. And we're seeing that divide in the battle over whether Britain should remain in the EU, with older generations, in a sense, feeling the country has changed, it's been changing too fast, and they would like Britain to be independent, standing alone in the world and protecting the interests of the British people, whereas the younger generation seem to be far more relaxed with the fact that Britain has become this very global, integrated, multi-ethnic, multi-racial community, and they feel very happy about that. They've grown up with mixed-race friends, they've grown up with friends with different religious views, and so they're used to that and they don't see a problem with that.
I also find it really striking what you referred to before. She's not, you know, some kind of political elite from the traditional channels of power in the UK. She's a mother. She's a very approachable person with a bio that seems to embrace rather than exclude.
Yes, and she was popular not just within her party, she was popular across the House of Commons. She was a very open, vivacious personality. What has also surprised me is how many conservative politicians have come out and told stories about how they met her in the tea room at the House of Commons, and she was always open to talking to people and always wanted to hear their views. And even if she disagreed, she would argue vociferously her point, but she was open to other people's opinions and other people's views. And she was really an advocate of very pluralist democratic politics. And, you know, since we had the expenses scandals in the House of Commons a few years ago, we've had a media and a public that's been very cynical about politicians. People assume that they're self-interested, they're venal, they're liars, they're cheats. And she really epitomizes the complete antithesis of that. And it reminds people that a lot of people who go into politics, a lot of people in her generation in their late 30s, early 40s, who go into politics because they're really politically committed people who are going to politics for the public service because they want to help people. And it's a very important reminder that we need to think about our politicians in a very different way than we've been thinking about them in recent years.
Simon Hicks, Professor of Political Science at the London School of Economics. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
All you really have to say to U.S. Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera is, "What have you got on Orlando, Juan?" And his words flow forth. Here's part of a poem he wrote this week for the people in Orlando and all of the rest of us.
How can it be so? And his big, sexy life, the one that covers us all, no matter our letters. LGBTQ, LGBTQ, LGBTQQQU.
Juan Felipe Herrera was named Poet Laureate of the United States exactly a year ago, a year that began with the terrifying shooting in the AME church in Charleston, South Carolina, now bracketed at the other end by the Orlando tragedy. Herrera thinks of his year as a time of reckoning in a violent America, but also what he calls a festival of faces and voices traveling around America. And sounding a bit like an exuberant Lin-Manuel Miranda, he invited me to do some poetry freestyling with him, something he says he's been doing with new friends and fans across the country all year long.
What do we need? Morning light or night light or a traffic light?
Stop, go, stop, go. Someone's commanding someone, but we're not in control. Why?
Someone going too fast, someone going too slow, and the people are on the side, on the other side of the sidewalk, and then they walk.
What do you see as your responsibility, thinking about this whole year and then thinking about these events? And you began at Charleston, and you end up here at Orlando, a small distance on the map, but quite a distance in this year. And it hasn't all been violence and shooting.
No, it hasn't all been violence and shooting. That's true. And when there is violence and shooting, then I stop and listen and tune in as best as I can as a poet, as a human being, and respond with what I can respond. And in many cases, in some cases, I respond with poetry. And then when I go to events, you know, make presentations at schools and universities, or art centers or community centers, I take a moment to read these poems and also invite people to come up with me and read with me. I have a number of performance poems that are in different voices, and I'll invite someone that I meet in the audience or before my reading, and that are reading, and I'll say to myself, oh, they're great. So I'll invite them to read with me.
Connect the Charleston moment to the Orlando moment, if there's a way to do it. I mean, sometimes I worry that we focus on the dark things so often in America, and they're a part of what's going on, but they're not everything.
As soon as a violent action takes place, people come out. You know, people come out with flowers and songs and candles, and they get in cars and they go to the location and of all colors and, you know, all faiths and all styles, young and old. And we see this great tsunami of devotion, of heart, of love. And we, in a very ironic and reality way, we see that right next to terror and death, there's beauty and humanity. And it happens this way all the time. And there's also, you know, everyday life as well. You know, I go to readings and I see just hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people just filled with happiness. And I notice their faces one by one, and they're happy and they're smiling, and they're young, and they're elders too. And you know, there are many, many, many joyous people doing joyous things. And I meet artists and I go to their studios, their little studios like in Corvallis, Oregon. And I see the paintings on the walls and they say, can I make something for you, Juan Felipe? I go, no, you're fine. I'm fine. Oh, no, let me give you some bread that I just made make you an omelet and with mushrooms. I go, okay, well, thank you so much. So very generous peoples that we have in our midst. And, of course, we don't see them in the news or in the paper. They just are the gardens that are growing every day, and we walk right by them at times.
All poets, I think, that at least that I've encountered in my small connection to the literary world, seem to have a sense of service, that poetry is a service to the language. It's a service to feelings. It's a service to humanity in some way. It's a service to the poets who have come before. What has this year taught you about poetry as a service?
That it's a continuous action, and that it's a beautiful aspect of society, and of course of poetry. I've always done this since I started out in the late 60s as a poet with the civil rights movement and the Chicano, Latino, Latina literary movimiento. So it's kind of part of all this. I've been part of all this in a way. But the lens has gotten bigger, the stadium has gotten bigger, and the peoples are of all colors and all ages and in all regions and national, international now. So I learned that about poetry in a very personal, elastic audience and myself and people, kind of almost like as if the poem is everyone right in front of me as I read it, and it is. I can sense that it's a very human thing. It's not just me going up in a cafe, which is the same actually, reading, but because it's so energized, I can actually feel the human waves of it all, the human intersections of this piece of paper I have in my hands. And of course, it's in a way being moved and shaped by those that are present. They're kind of writing the poem with me as I read it. They're kind of moving me around. I'm like a minnow. I'm a poetry minnow now. I used to be like a poetry whale because I was trying to get the poem out, and there were maybe two people out there. Back in Kirchhoff Plaza at UCLA, for example, I would try out my voice because I was still tempering my voice. I was still trying to see if I could actually stand up and read or say something. And I was so nervous that I had to kind of scream. I said, if I scream, if I'm very loud, you know, people won't notice, you know, how afraid I am right now, how I can just stop at any second and run and, you know, be happy. I've gone from that to stepping in front of thousands. So so I'm no longer the project. I'm no longer the project. I'm just a minnow. And everyone else is doing the poetry in many ways because they're the ones who are moving me around in this ocean, this big ocean of life. Loving life, is that a crime? I ask you from here. Loving life, is that a crime this time, next time? We shall not forget you, Orlando. We shall march for you, Orlando. I will love you forever.
Juan Felipe Herrera, poet laureate of the United States. You can hear him reading his entire poem, I Will Love You Forever, Orlando, at thetakeaway.org. As summer approaches, can we be precise about where country music is at this point? Johnny Cash, Dolly Parton, Garth Brooks, Taylor Swift. Many movements in country music. Our culture reporter, Melissa Locker, whose work has been featured in The Guardian and Time, says we've reached a new, more progressive version of country in 2016, with artists finding different ways to the top of the charts.
Modern country music, you know, it's inspired by Hank Williams Sr.
Right.
and Hank Williams Jr. I think it's kind of more of a throwback to the older country, less of the glitz and the glamour that you'd see. Like if you listen to Margot Price, for example, her album is called Midwest Farmer's Daughter, which is clearly a reference to Loretta Lynn. And I feel like there's a kinship between them.
Not put hurting on the bottle. Baby, not running the sea.
Dolly Parton, but with a very straight arrangement piano in there.
Exactly. And Margaret Price had been around Nashville for a very long time. She'd recorded this album, but she couldn't get anybody to listen to it. And then she eventually became Third Man Records, which is Jack White's record label. She became their first ever country signing, which kind of shows the alternative pathways to getting signed and getting success and getting their music out there. Now, William Tyler, who has a new album out this week called Modern Country, he's a similar story in that he is signed to Merge Records, which is home to Superchunk and Arcade Fire and very kind of different bands. And his music, if you listen to it, you'll see it's missing something very important.
You don't mean it's missing the vocal, do you?
He's a purely instrumental artist. He tells stories about slavery and about a Mississippi county who was anti-slavery in the middle of the Civil War, and it's all done instrumentally.
Now, I can hear in, you know, some country bar somewhere, if somebody puts this on the box, that someone's going to scream, where's the vocal? This is new age.
I can see some people thinking that, but I think it's also a way that people are redefining country music and making it their own. It's a way of reclaiming it from the Garth Brooks of the world.
Mm-hmm. Kacey Musgraves, pageant material, seems almost an ironic suggestion of maybe the glitziness of the past. The album is Pageant Material from Kacey Musgraves.
Just hold your own road.
Kind of Roseanne Cash there.
Yeah, she's really fun, but she's also a pretty groundbreaking artist for country in that she's kind of an open pot smoker, which makes her kind of weird for country music. I mean, not that country music hasn't had a lot of drug users in the past.
That's interesting. Chris Stapleton, Traveler, tell me about that.
Well, Chris Stapleton has been around country music for a very long time, but last year he made waves by not only getting nominated and winning the Best Country Album of the Year, the Grammy Awards, but he was also a huge crossover artist where he went up for Album of the Year going against Kendrick Lamar and Taylor Swift. And his music is just great, and I think fans of all genres are really going to find something to like about him.
Gutsy, From the Heart, John Hiatt sounded.
And another artist that we should definitely talk about is a guy named Jason Isbell, who came out of Drive-By Truckers and is this beautiful, just...
I love Drive-By Truckers.
Yeah, and Jason Isbell's solo music is really pushing the boundaries of country music and kind of making it his own in much the same way as these other artists. He's telling these beautiful stories that are, you know, so sad and so truthful and just incredibly honest.
Melissa Locker is culture reporter for The Takeaway. She's written for Time, Vanity Fair, and The Guardian.
You want answers?
You haven't answered my question.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
So, do you come to Milwaukee often?
You know how fast you were going?
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
You're gonna have to answer to the Coca-Cola Company.
You can't handle the truth!
Can we handle Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday? Oh, yes, every Friday. That's exactly what we do. Rafer, welcome.
Hi, John.
Nice to see you. We've got two of, it's fair to say, probably the beginning summer blockbusters to talk about this weekend. But let's get to something that people might miss if they focus too much on Dory and the fishbowl. The movie Tickled. It's a documentary, but that just begins to describe it here.
We stake out the studio, hoping to find out how a competitive tickling shoot goes down.
Can you see what the car's doing? I've lost him.
Who's that guy?
Oh, that's Marco.
That's the guy from New Zealand.
Yep.
Hey, it's Kevin.
It sounds utterly trivial. Sounds silly, unimportant, but it's not.
It begins as an investigation into what looks like a sport called competitive endurance tickling. Which you can find online. You'll see men fully clothed tickling each other with dead seriousness, at least until one of them starts laughing hysterically. The reporters, David Ferrier, he's a television reporter from New Zealand, and his partner, Dylan Reeve, explore this. And what they find is something far, far different. It's a pattern of power, control, abuse, where these men who participate in the videos, when they stop participating, the people who commissioned these videos begin to harass them, threaten them, smear them, publicly humiliate them.
And we don't want to spoil anything about this because there's a huge reveal at the end. We'll move on to the other two movies, but don't forget about Tickled, David Ferrier and Dylan Reeve. It's a documentary, but a whole lot more. And you would recommend this?
I would. It's in limited release now, just New York and LA, but it opens up much wider next week.
Finding Dory.
Dory!
Ah! Where did you go?
You were the one to go!
My parents! I remember them!
Wait, what did you remember?
I remember them! My mom, my dad! I have a family! They don't know where I am.
Animation, short-term memory, an aquatic species, what's not to love about Finding Dory? Is it a sequel that works?
Well, we all loved Finding Nemo, right?
Yeah.
Who among us
Classic.
Does not, right? And Dory was a great sidekick.
Yeah.
Ellen DeGeneres plays the blue tang with the memory loss problem.
Made her career.
This might make me sound like a terrible person. In this movie, I find Dory just a little bit irritating. I find that as a sidekick, she was very enjoyable. As the heroine of this story, her problems can get a little maddening as she leads everybody on these wild goose chases. But this is still a good Pixar movie. DeGeneres' voice is still great. Albert Brooks as Marlin is still wonderful. And Ed O'Neill from Modern Family and Married with Children, he plays Hank the Octopus. He's one of the film's best creations. It's no match for Finding Nemo, but I still think it's a great, fun, inventive kids film from Pixar.
A test of fun comes in our final movie this week, Central Intelligence.
Robert, I would like to go home now, please.
Buddy, you and me both. But until we clear our names, there's no going home.
I'm sorry, can you clarify that last sentence for me?
Yeah, well, now that you're in...
Let me stop you right there. I'm not in. I never said that I was in. In fact, I expressly remember saying that I was out.
I know, but they think you're in.
I'm freaking out! I'm out!
So is it just me, or does Dwayne Johnson sound a lot like Barack Obama?
I think that's just you.
That's just me. Anyway, Central Intelligence, a comedy?
Comedy, action comedy. That's Dwayne Johnson as a CIA super agent. Kevin Hart is his old high school friend. He ropes him into a mission. Pretty standard stuff, but, you know, these kind of comedies work when the team works, and these two are terrific together. And I have said it before, I'll say it again. I think The Rock is a terrific comedic actor.
Dwayne Johnson, pal.
I'm
not going to get an interview with him if you call him The Rock.
You're right about that. I'm sorry. He's great in this movie. What's great about him is he plays a guy who used to be an overweight nerd in high school and is now a big muscle guy, but he's still that kid inside.
Some Pixar animation makes that older character as well. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too, John.
Why Wish Upon a Star? Now Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist and TV star, grapples with that question once again. Why do we earthbound humans feel the need to look up?
So I would claim no matter how you slice the question, what does it mean to look up? No matter who answers that question, they're going to tell you that looking up is something beautiful, something profound, something deep. In more ways than one, it contains our destiny.
That perfect, dark, undistorted sky was destiny for Tyson's mentor, Carl Sagan, decades ago in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn.
Even with an early bedtime, in winter you could occasionally see the stars. Cities were not as polluted then. I asked people what the stars were, and they said, they're lights in the sky, kid. And so when I got my first library card, I fairly breathlessly asked the librarian for a book on stars.
This is Marcy calling from Northport, New York, and I'd like to give you a little bit of a poem that I learned in my childhood. I stood upon that silent hill and stared into the sky until my eyes went blind with stars, and still I stared into the sky.
Oh, thanks, Marcy, and oh, for the days of Carl Sagan's youth. Marcy's part of a chorus of voices, listeners to this program, expressing sadness over the sky receding. behind a curtain of industrial light that has sucked the magic out of the stars. The Milky Way is reportedly invisible to 99% of the U.S. population and 80% of the world population as a result of light blocking out the stars. Jason Kendall is an adjunct professor of astronomy at William Paterson University, board member of the Amateur Astronomers Association of New York, but he's our favorite star man. Jason Kendall, welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be back.
You know, this light business is really, really serious in terms of cutting off our connection to the heavens. Tyson talks about it. You've talked about it.
Yes.
I mean, you travel around to try to escape the light. You're kind of a vampire.
Yeah, I kind of am a little bit of a vampire. I do go lots of different places. I was just up at Cherry Springs State Park, which is in northwestern Pennsylvania, about a week and a half ago, which is a dark sky location. And you can actually get lost trying to count the stars up there. And the Milky Way is absolutely clear. You can see the Great Northern Coal Sack. You can see the division inside the Milky Way. You can see nebula naked eye, like the Lagoon and the Eagle Nebula. Those are visible there, and they're very low in the sky. But it's absolutely an astonishing thing. I don't think that anybody probably understands just how much they're missing until they go see it, and then they just are stunned by it. They're stunned by what they see and the wonder that comes with it.
This is different than, you know, looking at the moon through binoculars or dragging a telescope out to see nebula and stuff. You can see this all with the naked eye.
Absolutely.
This is what the, you know, pharaohs looked at on top of the pyramids.
Absolutely.
And we don't have access to it because we have to go to these dark sky locations. How difficult are they to get to?
Actually, some of them are relatively easy. Cherry Springs is only about a 4.5-5 hour drive from New York City, and it's pretty easy to get to. There's some other places that where you can see the Milky Way. It's still got sky brightness, like Western New Jersey at UACNJ, which is an astronomy club.
And part of this story is not just a, oh, well, we've ruined the Earth in another way once again. NASA and other government organizations and scientific organizations have created an atlas that not only plots the light pollution but also tells us the places where we can go to see the sky, because there are plenty of places on Earth to actually see it. It's just that we humans are crowded together in places where you can't.
That's right. I mean, don't get me wrong. When we live in the city, that's where everything's really happening. But sometimes what you need to do is to get for your soul to get out of that hubbub and that motion of the day, because there's something very different between the day and the night. And the day energy is extraordinarily different than your night, quote, energy, however you want to put it. But you feel differently. Your home runs are different. Everything is different. And so experiencing night is fundamentally human. It's really who it's another side of us. Even when we think about people like Joe Campbell, who talked about the hero's journey, I actually felt that like 2 years ago up at Cherry Springs. I was there. I stayed up all night, dusk to dawn, and I felt like I was taking this journey with the paths of the stars as I actually watched them move. You don't notice the sun moving through the day, but you always notice the stars as they rise. And that's something you can't not see when you're in a dark place.
You are a vampire, Jason Kendall. How long does it take your eyes to get used to the darkness? I mean, a lot of people feel like, oh, they go out into the country and they look up at the stars on their way into the house and they go, oh, that's so beautiful. Right. But if you stay there for a while, it gets multiple times more profound.
That's right. It takes about 15 to 20 minutes to get good and dark adapted, but about an hour later, it gets even better. So you have these layers of vision, and it's what's beautiful about it is that you're actually using very low light aspects of your eye, and so you're using the aspects of your eye that are very good at detecting line and shape and movement.
I love this. So in 15 minutes, it's really great, but then after an hour, it's really, really great, and this is all completely legal.
Exactly. That's what's funny is that people like to go out and say, oh, let's do this and do that. But I found people when they do that, they actually stop. I mean, when you get to a place, it's like, why bother having some sort of mixture in you when you can actually just see what you actually really can see? And the change.
Stone cold sober. Keep it that way. The Stonehenge. Before we go, what dark sky did you grow up with?
I grew up in Springfield, Illinois. And from my front porch in the downtown of the capital of Illinois, I was able to see it. That was late 1970s.
Jason Kendall, an adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University, urging us to get outside in the dark, away from the light, to see the heavens. He's a board member of the Amateur Astronomers Association of New York. And your nephew is driving up?
Yes, my nephew Nathan is driving up to grab a telescope.
And you're going to give him your old 15-incher?
Yes, he's coming on up with his brother, and I'm giving him my 15-inch telescope, which just sounds like a crazy thing, and it is. But it's staying in the family, which is a wonderful thing.
Beautiful, beautiful. Let's hear some of our responses to the light shielding the heavens.
My name is Jim Barrett. I live in Ruffin, South Carolina. I live in the country. When I look up on a clear night, I can even see the Milky Way. I have a deep, soulful feeling that there must be others out there like us. There must also be a God somewhere out there far away.
Thank you, Jim. You keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway. And look up, won't you, at the heavens.